November 3rd, 1948. Dewey defeats Truman, reads the bold front page headline of the Chicago Daily Tribune. But of course, he had not. The polls had gotten it wrong. And if you keep up with the media, you might think polls continue getting it wrong. But do they? Are polls scientific? Are polls reliable? Welcome back to The Connector, where we bring together innovative, groundbreaking, and collaborative research inside the UT Austin political science universe. I'm your host, Stuart Tendler. In this episode, we talk with three political scientists who know quite a lot about polling. We ask Robert Luskin, Darren Shaw, and Chris Valesian whether complaints about polling methods are valid. Bucking popular perception, our guests suggest that such complaints are misleading, often missing the point, or ignoring inconvenient truths. In fact, in important ways, polls are becoming more accurate. But why do the media pay attention to polls, regardless? Is reporting on polls the equivalent of a news media junk food binge, or a serious component feeding their storytelling needs? We close this episode with an in-depth statement about the margin of error in polling, and an explanation as to why the media often misreads this statistic. Why don't we just start with everybody briefly introducing themselves, letting us know who's here.
I'm Bob Luskin. I'm a professor here at UT and have co-written actually an article about pre-election media polls with Darren and Mark Hetherington at Vanderbilt. I'm also advising the French National Election Study.
I'm Darren Shaw. I'm a professor here at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm co-director of the Fox News poll, along with Chris Anderson of Anderson Robbins Research. I'm one of the co-PIs, or principal investigators, for the Texas Tribune University of Texas Government Department poll, which is a regular statewide poll of Texas. And I'm a member of the Fox News decision team.
I'm Chris Valesian, also a professor of government here at the University of Texas at Austin, and I do work on polling of all sorts, really, from vote intentions over the course of campaigns to public preferences for policy and the relationship with what policymakers actually do.
Great. Well, thanks to each of you for being here. I figured it's a presidential election year. It would make sense to talk to three people who know a lot more than a lot of people about polls. I wanted to start off, so I have this article by Jill Lepore that was in the November 2015 issue of The New Yorker, and the little subtitle says, "Polling may never have been less reliable or more influential than it is now." And then if I could fast forward to the very end of the article, quoting Donald Trump, she writes, "Do we love these polls?" He called out to a crowd in Iowa. Somebody said, "You love polls." I said, "That's only because I've been winning every single one of them." Right, right, every single poll. 2 days later, when he lost his lead in Iowa to Ben Carson, he'd grown doubtful. "I honestly think those polls are wrong." By the week of the third GOP debate, he'd fallen behind in a national CBS New York Times poll. "The thing with these polls, they're all so different," Trump said mournfully. "It's not very scientific." So that would be the first question I would pose. Are polls scientific? Are polls reliable?
Well, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? I'm amused by the story just because my experience in polling has been that when someone doesn't like the result that occurs in a particular poll, they immediately become experts on methodology. And in fact, you know, with deference to Bob and Chris, I'm thinking that my middle name ought to be changed to Darren Flawed Methodology Shaw. So I always take these complaints about methodology with a large grain of salt. Now, having said that, the tough thing when I hear those sorts of complaints and arguments and observations on polls is that there are a lot of issues in contemporary polling, important issues about both the methodology, about the underlying populations that we're trying to survey and to get insight into. But the ones that tend to be identified by candidates or advocates of particular policy positions tend not to be the ones that I think really are of interest to those of us who do this stuff for a living. You know, so, and we can elaborate on this quite a bit, I'm sure, but, you know, questions about the advent of online polling, about the need for cell phone supplements to traditional polling, about likely voter samples, about list-based samples. These are things that are really important issues in the industry. and, you know, do lead to issues that can bias polls and, you know, produce results that don't square very well with election results. But, you know, these things are kind of treated in a not very detailed manner for obvious reasons, I think, when it comes to, you know, the public presentation of these things.
The context of that article, I take it, was the nomination campaign. And it is true that polls of candidate preferences in nomination campaigns are less reliable than corresponding polls in the general election, where party identification ties people down, makes their choices much more predictable. So you don't have that, of course, to distinguish between the candidates in a nomination campaign, and that means that people's preferences are much more labile, and there's a greater element of unpredictability.
Yeah, and one of the things, reflecting on both what Darren and Bob have said, the polling used to be really, really simple. Everybody used one single methodology and one pretty identical, very similar question. They would get their samples in a pretty similar way, and they would administer it in essentially the same way face-to-face. And we all went to phone, and we've gone now from maybe having one standard or perhaps two to having many, many different standards. And that's not to say that these are not scientific polls. Well, maybe there are different sciences, and these are maybe being practiced. Sciences are being practiced to a varying degree, which is all to say, I think, when we're in the lesson I think I try to emphasize with people, and I think Darren was reflecting on this and Bob has in the past with me as well, that it's really makes it less harder and harder for us to rely on the results of any single poll or polls of particular survey houses, which leads us to rely on, you know, aggregations, what we sometimes refer to as the poll of polls. And that way we're sort of, you know, we're not beholden to the decisions of a particular organization or a particular time point. There is an assumption there that these kind of errors that are in this polling, which is always the case, there's always error in polling, kind of cancel out, but which may not be the case. Maybe there's a systematic bias, but
There's some really interesting examples lately that get played up a lot. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. So you'll hear a lot of people comment on the Scottish independence vote, the last elections in Great Britain, the Israeli elections, as well as some high-profile elections in the United States, the Kentucky race from the last cycle, the Virginia race from 2014, where the conventional wisdom is the polls were massively off. One, I think that's overstated. They actually weren't as far off as a lot of people kind of popularly think. The Virginia case may be an exception to that, the one where the Republican was significantly understated. But they actually weren't that far off in Britain and in the case of the Scottish referendum.
Not at all.
In Israel. And in fact, and there's also the question of aggregating, you know, a question that basically asks what we call in the United States a generic ballot test. You know, who are you going to vote for Congress or the legislature? Translating that into seats. As you do in Great Britain or in Israel. And so there are some of these questions of aggregation. But more fundamentally, they weren't that far off. And yet there's been this tale told about how inaccurate the polls are. And some of the work that Bob and I have done with Mark Hetherington has suggested a couple things. One, even today, and we're still collecting data from the last couple of cycles, but they're not that far off. I think the latest estimate we have, Bob, is a point and a half or something like that. And they're not off, maybe even more importantly for consumers out there, they're not consistently off with respect to direction. There's a slight tendency over time, and Bob, you might remember that a little better than I do.
There's more than one branch to this research. The one we've been focusing on has to do with the signed error, that is, taking account, we're looking at not just how far the poll is off, but which way it errs, toward the Democrat or toward the Republican. But another branch, which we're not actively working on at the moment, but we've looked at, has to do with the absolute magnitude of the error. And at least in our data, which do not include the last few cycles, we're working on that, at least in our data, there's been a very noticeable downward trend in the error, in even the absolute error in pre-election polls. So they've been getting, at least up to the point at which our data stop for the moment, they've been getting more accurate, despite the handicaps that pollsters face. I wanted to pick up on something that Chris said, and Darren just addressed it as well, that this has to do with the treatment of polls in the media. I think one reason for this overstatement of the degree of error that both Darren and Chris pointed to is that the media do not generally focus on the average of polls, which, as I agree with Chris, is what they should be doing. Instead, they take the polls one by one, and the latest poll, whatever it is gospel. You know, that's the way things are, even if it's an outlier. That's the way things are. And of course, it's the most vivid examples of, especially in retrospect, looking at the election results, it's the most vivid examples that remain in the in media's memory. So they remember the cases that were far off, forgetting the ones that were close or off in the other direction. So the average is still pretty close, but what they remember is the ones that were way off. In general, I could not agree more that what the media should be doing is not focusing on each poll as it comes out, but reporting a running average. The polls done in an appropriate period, they will be more accurate than any single poll if you take the average.
Yeah, I think that's right. In fact, I think the aggregate statistics from 2012 and 2008, and I'm referring here to, for instance, some of the work that Nate Silver has done on 538.com, where he predicts basically using these averages. There's some question about how he weights them, but even if you had just done, say, the Real Clear Politics average of right. polls, that I believe you would have gotten 49 out of 50 states yep. in one election and 50 out of 50 in the other, and that's with no complicated weighting or anything like that. So I agree with Chris and Bob about how, there are, of course, errors in these polls, but they're not that far off. And certainly collectively, they really give you a pretty instructive picture about what's going on.
But most of, I think, what we're talking about here pertains to general elections.
It's true. That's right.
That's true. Certainly our research is strictly general election.
Right, yeah. Right.
And mine is mostly focused on that as well. But it's a lot trickier when we're facing trying to predict primary elections.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's, the question of using national poll results versus state by states. And some of these states that become very important every 4 years in the presidential cycle tend to be under-polled. I don't know what a good sample of Vermont looks like. Because it's never competitive at the senatorial level, and it's never competitive at the presidential level. But a couple weeks ago, we were all very interested in the Vermont primary and whether Kasich had closed on Trump. And turns out he had, although I don't know that any polls necessarily got that right. I'm sort of fairly impressed by polls of Ohio or Florida because there's so many institutions and organizations that do it, and you can kind of judge whether one's an outlier. But if, say, North Dakota ever becomes a battleground state again, I have very little confidence that we have the expertise or background or there'll be the number of polls necessary to get it right.
Particularly to identify the Republican caucus goers.
Exactly.
That's right. Polls anticipating caucus votes are even more apt to be off than ones devoted to primaries.
Yeah. And I mean, so look, if you identify 400 Republicans from some list, registered voter list, and then you figure, okay, 15% of them are going to vote, how you get to that 15% is one issue. And then another is, well, if I've got 15% of 400, I don't have a very large sample from which to get a very accurate, picture of what the distribution of the vote's going to be.
There's a general point that, at least in my view, ought to be aired since we're talking about polls and to some degree about the media's use of them. And that is, to what extent, normatively, the media should be so obsessed with polling, or indeed should be reporting polls at all. In my view, this is the junk food of political discourse. It's free of nutritive value. It's what people should be talking about, and what the media should be letting the candidates convey to us is their policy positions. That's what people should be voting on. To focus so much on polling, I understand why they do it. It's a way of avoiding any risk of bias. This is science. We can point to the numbers in polling and makes reporting easier. But it's not useful to voters. It may be affirmatively unuseful to voters. It may lead people to vote for the candidate who looks as though he or she's going to win. And that's not the grounds on which people in a democracy should be voting.
Well, but we do know there's, I completely agree, but we do know there's work showing that people love these polls, right? That if you give readers of a newspaper an opportunity to choose between the latest horse race coverage and the next installment on some policy issue, they tend to gravitate to the former.
Well, one thing you do realize when you see the other side of the picture, and that is from the media's point of view, and I underappreciated this earlier in my career, but I have a pretty decent appreciation for it now, is their need to tell stories. Mm-hmm. So you conduct a poll and you give the top line results. You say Trump is winning by 10 points. And then you start telling stories about angry voters, about disaffected voters, about uneducated voters. And, you know, the more content there is out there with the web and with 24-hour cable, the more need there is to tell stories. I mean, when I started doing decision team work and exit polling work, I thought the top of the hour call was the big deal, you know, that we would say whether a candidate won a state or not. And it turned out, no, the top of the hour call lasts about 1 minute. And then they got another 59 minutes, you know, minus 12 minutes for commercials, to talk about something. And so it's what the exit polls do, certainly on election night, and I think probably these other polls too, is they allow you to, you know, not just say that Trump's winning, but give me some sort of story. And as we've suggested, sometimes that story is not terribly correct in some sense, but sometimes it is, but they need to tell a story.
Well, the story also influences the way they present the polling numbers. I remember noticing, I don't remember exactly which candidates were involved, but earlier in this present nomination campaign, there was a poll on both Republicans and Democrats, and the reporting on, was, you know, candidate X is ahead of candidate Y on the Republican side by 9 points, exclamation point. And then there was a 9-point gap between candidates Z and W on the Democratic side. And the way that was phrased was, well, candidate Z is only ahead of candidate W by 9 points. You know, it was the same numerical difference. But that's what fit their narrative.
Coming back to the point you made about the trial heat, you know, focus on the horse race and all that, and how that might not be the most important thing for them to be focusing on. I don't mean to show for an organization, but there's a big well-known survey organization by the name of Gallup, which agrees with you. In fact, they've abandoned that part of their polling and actually increased their polling of substantive opinion, which is a striking change.
There are also several countries that have unsuccessfully banned either pre-election polls or the publication of them.
Especially at
because
the end.
Of this.
I'm all in favor of a black market for polls. I'd like to fill that niche. And I have this piracy kind of thing about it. I think that's be kind of cool, actually, you know, renegade pollsters. But I don't want to go to prison for polling. So the one thing I'll say, and I don't disagree with what Bob has said about, I think it was the junk food quality of the ballots. There is a literature in with respect to nomination politics, we see presidential primaries, that talks about how people use information about viability. And viability meaning, you know, the chances that a candidate is got a chance to actually win the nomination, and that this is what the early contests do. This is what polling has kind of done. It allows Republicans, for instance, to discriminate between Carly Fiorina or Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and others. Now, I don't know that I think that using that information is necessarily a good thing, but I'm not sure it's not a good thing for those voters. You know, is it useful for me to, you know, look up in a Texas poll and find that a candidate I might have supported has zero support, but someone who's reasonably close to my preferences has a chance to win? This is a unique condition in the United States of presidential politics, but I'm trying to think of exceptions maybe to the junk food rule.
It applies in all multi-party systems, too.
It does. That's
strategic
kind of
and tactical.
Yeah.
So I do think that's a benefit of polling information, assuming a reasonable degree of accuracy. But it doesn't negate, or in my view, fully counterbalance the problematic side of things. So
sure,
it makes it easier for you to judge which of two candidates you think you largely agree with you should vote for on the basis of which has the greater chance of winning the election or getting the nomination. But it makes it much harder for you to judge who you generally agree with if you're not getting policy information. Can I change the subject to still staying with polling, of course, but I didn't want our time to elapse without my getting to mention probably my greatest dissatisfaction with reporting of polls, which is the use of the margin of error to dismiss many results as a, quote, statistical tie when they are no such thing. There's a kind of twisty logic behind this from classical statistical inference that if you assume that two candidates are actually tied and there's a margin of error of, say, 4%, that means that the probability of seeing an observed difference between them of greater than 4% is less than 0.05, a 1 in 20 chance. If the difference between them is less than 4%, then there is a greater than 0.05 chance of that's occurring by chance, right? The question is, does this, since any sample is a random draw, ideally a random draw from the population, the results will always be different from what's true of the population in some degree. Occasionally, they'll be very different just by chance. So the question is, what's the probability of seeing what you see if their candidates are really tied? But if the margin of error is 4% and the candidates are 2 or 3% apart, it is still very unlikely, not 0.05, but maybe 0.2 or something like that, still very unlikely that you'd see those results by chance. The candidate who is, say, 2 points ahead with a 4-point margin of error is very likely ahead. And to dismiss it as a statistical tie really is wrong.
And it's another argument for pooling the polls as well. Yes, if you've noticed the tendency, well, one poll comes out, 500 respondents, there's a 3% difference, but it's not statistically significant. We have another one which shows a 4% difference, not significant. Another one with 3%. If we add them together, we easily find them. Mm-hmm.
This is my Ohio example from 2012, where President Obama was up in, I want to say, 10 consecutive polls, all within margin of error.
Right.
and so you had people saying, like, well, this is within margin of error. But if you calculate the chances that Obama is behind,
when you
have seen 10 consecutive surveys showing right. him ahead by 1 point even, it's infinitesimal. So, you know, in fact, think about that logically, right? If we are actually tied, or if, you know, Romney is ahead, what are the chances that I'm going to draw 10 straight polls showing the opposite?
Flipping heads.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Right. And that is a common scenario. Frequently in a close election, you will find a series of polls, all with results within the margin of error, but all pointing in the same direction. And that's because each of them is probably individually, the results showing, you know, candidate X with a slim lead should be taken seriously. and evidence of that is that candidate X has a slim lead in, you know, 5 other polls.
And to try as we might, there's a real, you know, incentive not to reflect that in a lot of reporting, right? It makes the race a lot less interesting to say that Obama has Ohio in the bag, right?
So, are you convinced about the margin of error? Thanks for listening to this episode of The Connector, where we dove into the world of polling. If you are anything like me, you'll be thinking about polls just a little bit differently from now on. Stay tuned for part 2 of this episode, when we turn our attention toward November 2016. If you have any questions or comments, you can find me at gov.utexas.edu.